This is Fresh Air. Former tennis champion Arthur Ashe died this past weekend. He was the first African-American man to win the U.S. Open and Wimbledon. But he was also known around the world for his stance on political issues and for the time that he spent in public service. Ashe began competing in tennis in the 1950s, when the courts in his home state of Virginia were still segregated, and the world of professional tennis was, for all practical purposes, a white world. After winning major tournaments around the world, his playing career ended at the age of 36 in 1980 after a heart attack and quadruple bypass surgery. He served as the national campaign chairman of the American Heart Association. Then, in 1988, he was diagnosed with the AIDS virus, and last year, after he went public with his condition, created a foundation for AIDS research and education. Terry Gross spoke with Arthur Ashe in 1989, after he had just written a three-part history on African-American athletes. He said that although he grew up believing that lots of jobs were off-limits to blacks, the world of sports was beginning to change.
Well, when I became 10, 11, 12 years old, we're talking about the early to mid-50s now, the color line had been broken in the major team sports. There was already a broken line of sorts in boxing and track, but it had not been broken until that period between 1946 and 1950 in basketball, football, baseball, tennis, golf, bowling, and some others. And so I was a sports nut as a child and able to follow the exploits of a Jackie Robinson or Althea Gibson. And in that respect, I was quite fortunate. But not knowing that, had I been born just 2 or 3 years earlier, that would not have been the case.
How did tennis become your sport?
I was always a very good little athlete. I was fast and I was quick, but I was not very big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not going to play football. I wasn't tall enough to really do that well in basketball. I learned how to swim at a very early age, but was not that interested. Soccer was no longer, was not popular yet. And I also played tennis, I think, because it was not a team sport. It was just me by myself out there alone. And I also, in addition, believe that I gravitated towards sports and books as a way to get over the death of my mother, which occurred when I was just 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I think books and sports may have saved me from going slightly nuts.
You've pointed out that when you were coming of age, blacks really had no identification with the sport of tennis. And I was wondering if that was ever an obstacle to your appreciation of the sport.
Not really. I knew who the black sports heroes were in the field of tennis. People like Jimmy McDaniel. Of course, we were all aware of Althea Gibson and very proud of her for having blazed the trail. And I knew some of the other very good black players, but all of us knew that we wanted to play at Forest Hills, or wanted to play in the Davis Cup, or wanted to play at Wimbledon, and in the late 40s that was just not possible. But that didn't stop us from wanting to realize our dreams in any event.
Did anyone ever try to discourage you and tell you that there was very little room for black players in the sport?
No, not discouragement to the extent of saying, stop because there's only so high you can go, no. But it was certainly pointed out that there were no, with the exception of Althea, there were no black role models that you could point to that had gone as far as she had gone, especially no men, no men at all, completely none.
It's funny because it's usually the opposite way, right?
Yes, yes,
in most sports.
Yes, that's exactly right. But and it's still that way today. That is, to the extent that there may be more black participation in the sport like tennis in the future, I think most of the participation in the next decade or so will be females rather than males.
What was the world of black tennis like when you started to play?
Well, it was a very self-contained world, largely confined to the East Coast cities of Durham, North Carolina, Richmond, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Montclair, New Jersey, New York City, New Haven, Connecticut, Boston. There were some outposts in Wilberforce, Ohio. Any place in the South that had a black college was a mecca for black tennis. And Kansas City and Los Angeles. And, oh yes, those Houston and Dallas were meccas, and Prairie View, Texas, because that was the site of a rather large black college, Prairie View A&M. And those were the places where blacks congregated from year to year, and summer to summer, to play and to socialize and meet one another. And that went on from 1916, and it continues until this very day.
Were there tournaments that you wanted to play in that you were barred from because of segregation?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. I was barred from all official sanctioned events in my home state. In fact, I only played in one sanctioned event in my home state as a junior player in my life. That was when I was 18, and I came back to play in the National Interscholastics, that is the national tournament for high school athletes. That was held in Charlottesville, Virginia in 1961. That's the only integrated or sanctioned event I ever played in my own home state as a junior.
You're listening to a 1989 interview that Terry Gross did with tennis champion Arthur Ashe. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with Arthur Ashe.
You were the first black to win many of the titles that you won. You were the first black to win the Junior Davis Cup, the first black to get a UCLA tennis scholarship, the first black to win Wimbledon. I think the first also
black,
to win...
Black man.
Black man, okay, right.
Yes.
Also the same for the U.S. Open. What were some of the pressures that went along with being the first black or first black man to win some of these titles?
Well, the pressures were more closely associated with certain time periods.
Uh-huh.
I felt enormous pressure in the 60s because that was the decade of the era of the black social revolution. That's when Dr. King started his crusades, and you had your sit-ins and your freedom rides and summer trips to Selma, Alabama, and you had the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act coming into being in 64 and 65. And Malcolm X was in his heyday, and the Vietnam War, and Muhammad Ali refusing to cross the line for induction to the U.S. Army, and Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists at Mexico City at the Olympics. So against the background, the context of the 1960s, I felt enormous pressure to contribute to black social progress. In the 1970s, it all but disappeared. Any pressure one may have felt then, anybody black may have felt, was self-inflicted, self-imposed almost. It just completely disappeared. And now there's very little pressure to do anything, especially when compared with the era of the 1960s.
Do you think that's good or bad?
Well...
Or neither.
I mean. I'm sort of ambivalent about it.
Uh-huh.
There's no question I think it helped. No matter who you were or what endeavor your expertise was in, if you were a noted, if you had any degree of fame at all, you were expected to participate in the 1960s. And you were even badgered into it almost, in ways of trying to prove that you were blacker than somebody else. You know, your afro was bigger than your dashiki, was more African than the next black person's. That just completely disappeared in the 70s. And I can't find it at all in the 80s. And we know the reasons, but it's just sad to see it completely disappear because everybody now seems a bit more self-centered than they were before.
Mm-hmm. So you think some of those pressures that went along with the 60s were somewhat superficial, but on the other hand, you wish things were a little more political today?
Well, not so much superficial as someone like myself and quite a few people being in a position where if you were from the South, you were legally proscribed from doing a lot of things by whites.
Mm-hmm.
And here you were in the 60s being pressured into doing things by blacks who were in so-called leaders, positions of responsibility and influence. And you came to the point where you wanted to ask yourself, well, when do I get a chance to make up my own mind about something?
Uh-huh.
That's the situation I felt most deeply. All my life, up until I left school to go to college in California, I had whites telling me what I could and could not do, where I could and could not go. And all of a sudden, in the decade of the 60s, you have your black militants and other black leaders telling me what I should do solely because I'm black. And again, I would like to be able to make that decision for myself if I could once in life. But as far as tennis was concerned, For instance, the one area where I felt this tug both ways was in the issue of dealing with South Africa.
Yeah.
I was told in 1968 that if I wanted to go play in the South African Open, they probably wouldn't let me go because they don't allow blacks to play down there. Now, that had happened to me all my life as a junior in my own hometown, and I was in the position of saying, well, I'll be damned if that'll happen to me as a senior player. And when I wanted to go down there, you run into the opposition by some other blacks who say, you can't go down there because if you do, you'll be lending credence and credibility to that system. But I was just trying to prove a point that, hey, here's a country that said I can't play, and my position was, you either let me play or your tournament doesn't count. One of the two. Take your pick.
Mm-hmm. Athletes really have to be very single-minded to develop their abilities. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to figure out how to divide your energies between civil rights actions that you participated in or speaking out on behalf of certain issues and devoting your time to your sport.
Very difficult, very difficult. I got in trouble once when I was stationed at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I was an officer there and second lieutenant, and I made a speech in a black church in Washington that the Army thought was a bit too political. It was covered in the Washington Post, and I was called into the superintendent's office and told, in no uncertain terms, that if you do that again, you're going to be grounded, meaning we wouldn't be allowed to go out to play Davis Cup or whatever. Yet, you felt almost duty-bound to say something. Things were at such a fever pitch in 1968. That was the year, of course, when Dr. King was assassinated. That's when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. That's when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists. And looking back on it, I don't regret it at all, even though I know Army regulations forbid anybody in the Army from engaging in political activity. But you just felt almost compelled to say something.
That was Arthur Ashe speaking with Terry Gross back in 1989. Arthur Ashe died this past weekend. He was 49. This is Fresh Air.